Welcome to another Leon Chani Report, and we have a very interesting guest. Has been on the show for about 12 years, so it's got to be interesting. But he's more interesting for the fact that he went to Iraq to become basically the governor of Iraq for the United States government. Maybe I'm not using the correct term, but he'll correct me on everything. And everyone knows his name today. It's Paul Bremer, and he wrote a book called My Year in Iraq. He's lucky it's only a year. And the struggle to build a future for of hope, really. Right. That's a nice phrase. Paul, the last time you were on my show, you were talking about terrorism. That was your expertise. At that time, you were with Kissinger Associates, and I assume you've marched on to another career. What led you to go to Iraq? Why did you take such an assignment?
Well, I believe in public service. That's why I spent most of my adult life in public service. And I think that any American who has an opportunity to serve the country and who is asked by the president to take on a job basically should accept. And I supported the president. I supported the war in Iraq. I was concerned about terrorism. And so when the president asked me to take the job, I said yes. It turned out to be a lot harder than we thought it was going to be, but that was the only answer.
The first day you landed, what did you see? What did you find? Chaos?
Yeah, as I've written in my book, the thing that surprised me was that the looting, which had started almost immediately after the fall of Baghdad and about 3 weeks before I got there, the looting was still going on. In fact, there were fires all over Baghdad as I drove in from the airport. I could see ministry buildings on fire. I could see looters in the streets just carting furniture and television sets around. So
you get off a plane, you get into a car, you're sped away, you're on that highway, which was a really rough place to be, and you're seeing looters, the first sight that you see.
Right.
And so your mind is turning, because what was your official, were you governor? What was the official title?
Well, the Arabs used the term Hakim, as if I were a governor. In fact, I was the administrator of the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was the occupying authority.
All right, so for purposes of this show, we'll call you the administrator or Hakim if you're going to. All right, so you get off the plane and you see looting. And you say, hey, I'm the guy in charge. I'm supposed to take care of all this. So, okay, so you get into Baghdad. At that time, Baghdad had been captured. It was a great triumph. And you had to become the administrator to see how we put a civil society together. So what did you do your first day?
Well, of course, I did the usual things. The first day was meet the staff. I went through the palace where there were several thousand people already working, both military and civilian, and shook every hand in the place from the kitchen to the top. And then I had a meeting with the staff and told them that I was proud of their service to the country and we had a lot of work to do. Before I had left for Iraq, I had been shown a study that showed rather conclusively we didn't have enough troops on the ground. And that was a concern of mine really from the day I arrived to the day I left.
Did you express that to?
I did, yeah. I sent the study itself to my boss, who was Secretary Rumsfeld, and I mentioned it in a private breakfast I had with the president a couple of days before I left. At that time, they were hoping that they were going to be able to get some other countries to put more troops in, which turned out not to be the case, certainly not right away. But even if we'd had more countries, we weren't going to have enough troops. We needed something like twice as many.
So you knew right in the beginning you didn't have enough troops. You knew it.
I certainly did.
And the Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, knew it too. But what was his reaction?
Well, I don't know what conversations there were by then I was in Baghdad, between the Secretary and the service chiefs and the commander of CENTCOM, at that time General Franks, Tommy Franks. But it was a concern of mine. Now, I wasn't in the military chain of command, so I couldn't make anything happen there. What I had responsibility for was the political and economic reform and rebuilding of Iraq. There I could exercise authority. In the military chain, I could only make my views known and hope they were taken into account.
Yeah, I got to explain that to the office. Paul was not a czar over Iraq. A lot of people think that you were the czar, that you controlled the military, you controlled the civil, that you could make an assumption. You could say, well, I want to have an Iraqi government by Iraqis or not have an Iraqi government. There's a whole process that goes on when you're in government. I spent 10 years in the Washington games of the Senate and the White House. I know how it works. It is not easy. And you're not a czar. You're an administrator for civil affairs. Were the military cooperative with you, or they have their own set of rules and guides?
They were cooperative, but you know there are obviously going to always be tensions and conflicts, different ways of looking at it from the political side and the military side. That's to be expected. And in effect, the way it was set up, because I was working in the Pentagon, in the Department of Defense, these two chains of command came together in the form of the Secretary of Defense, because he was in both the military and civilian chain of command. So the problems when they came up, or disagreements when they came up, were basically referred up the chain to Rumsfeld.
Do you speak to Rumsfeld now?
I've seen him several times since I've been back.
Are you friendly with him?
I still consider him a friend. We had disagreements.
There's a lot of confusion about the role of Rumsfeld in this whole business. And at the end, I think the American public got a little bit angry at him. I mean, especially the way he held those press conferences. There was a little bit of hubris there, too. Mm-hmm. And people were disenchanted with him. And if you read the books, Douglas Feith wrote a book now about Rumsfeld, but he's very quiet. You don't hear a thing about him, and he's going to write a book now, so you have to give him the opportunity to express himself. But the key thing that you tell me now is that there was a forewarning in a memorandum to both the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and the President that they didn't have enough troops. So were you really, when you got to Iraq and you knew that situation existed, your problems were double fold, because you had to make decisions based on what you had on the ground, and you didn't know whether they'd come through with more troops.
Yeah, and the problem, we were the government of Iraq under international law.
We is the Americans?
The Coalition Provisional Authority.
Okay.
Under international law, by UN resolution, which recognized that fact, we were the occupying power. And that made us the government. We were responsible for running
services.
The government.
Right.
And the problem for the way I saw it was the most fundamental role of any government is providing security for its citizens. That's the sine qua non. Other things are nice to have. That you have to have.
Right. And you also need a banking system.
Well,
I can tell you.
Yeah, we had the problem with the banking system, too. We didn't have one of those either.
I know. Well, we'll talk about security first.
But
we'll
so on security, we were not providing the basic role of government. And that was really true, in my view, really, until the president changed the strategy a year ago in early 2007 with the surge and the change of military strategy. We went a very long time without having an effective security strategy and without having enough troops to carry it out.
Let me bring you back to 9/11. Where were you physically on 9/11?
I was actually on an airplane trying to get to New York that morning as I was
lucky living. You weren't on a different one.
Yeah. Well, I was on the shuttle.
So. Well, anything could have gotten hit.
Right.
All right. What was your visceral feeling?
Well, I'll tell you, the plane took off from Reagan and started to circle over Philadelphia, which it often did when there was traffic in New York. But that was a very clear day, as you remember. And I thought it was a bit strange that we were circling because there was no weather. I called my office. In those days, you could still call from the airplane, and told my secretary we were going to be late. And she said a second plane has just hit the World Trade Center. We'd heard about the first one from the pilot. And as soon as I heard that, I knew we were into a really major terrorist attack. It was not just some Piper Cub that flew into a building.
And your employment then was in the government or out of the government?
No, I was in running my own company at that point.
All right. So you saw the president's reaction. His chief of staff came in. He was in a classroom in Florida. Everybody was glued to television. My office is on 41st and Broadway. I got a call from Wolf Blitzer saying, you know, there's a big fire. Something happened. All of a sudden, boom. He says, there's another one going on. And we all knew that something was going on. So we all had these crazy feelings. We didn't understand what was happening. But you're a terrorism expert.
Right.
So did you think it could be as blatant as it was?
Yeah.
Did you ever have any thoughts like that?
Absolutely. I was honored to chair the Bipartisan National Commission on Terrorism in 1999 and 2000, and a group of 10 Republicans and Democrats. We reported to President Clinton 15 months before 9/11 that America faced a new Islamic extremist threat, terrorists who wanted to kill us by the tens of thousands. And we predicted that there would be Pearl Harbor-scale attacks on the American homeland. So while I was shocked by the attack, I was not surprised. As a matter of fact, as a complete irony, total by chance, on the cover of our report of the National Commission was the pictures of the Twin Towers.
Oh, my God.
Because of the first World Trade Center attack in 1993.
So basically the Clinton administration had a forewarning about the possibility.
The American people did. It wasn't just Clinton. The Clinton administration didn't do much about our report. Neither did the Bush administration until September 12th, 2001.
So why do you think that is, by the way?
Because that's what democracies do. Democracies basically react. They don't plan for the worst case any more than we plan for Pearl Harbor. That's the way we operate.
Do you know the only guy in history that I know who didn't plan that way? It was Ariel Sharon. He went to Lebanon in 1982. He went all the way up to Beirut.
Right.
He says, I'm going to preempt the PLO. And he wasn't waiting for them to attack. And he went to Menachem Begin, who was then the prime minister, and said, this is the way it's got to be. And Begin believed him. That war turned out to be a little bit of a little problem. Sabra and Shatila, if you remember those two camps.
I remember. I was working for Secretary Haig at that point. I remember it well.
Really? He's a good man, by the way, Haig. I've had him on this show. He's a great guy. He's getting in his 80s, I guess, now.
Yeah,
huh?
Probably.
He's a terrific guy. All right, so you see this, and you're now a private citizen. So how do you get this call to, well, first of all, it was a whole program before they decided to go into Iraq. I've interviewed everybody on this show, from Charlie Rangel to Mario Cuomo. Charlie Rangel physically came to my office and said, Leon, please, please call the president, tell him not to go into Iraq, not to go to war, please. He says, because mainly the poor and the underprivileged, I don't even mean black, are the ones that are going to get really harmed with this thing. I said, Charlie, you know, I don't have any great pull with Bush. I can call Jimmy Carter. I don't think Bush and Carter are having social tea tonight, so I don't think I can do anything about it. Mario Cuomo came on the show, but Mario Cuomo is the governor of New York. He's not a foreign policy expert. So we got to take a break for a minute and then come back. And you're going to tell me, basically, why you believe that we should go or should have gone into Iraq. And we'll go forward. Don't leave. Paul Bremer, fascinating guy. What a life.
Peace means taking into account the dignity of other people and the fact that there are other people who have certain rights.
Peace in the Middle East basically will come when the clergy in the mosque on Friday preach it and when the rabbis in the synagogue on Saturday preach it. During the time of Camp David I, you had political leadership that was able to contain that type of religious fervor. What the country needs is some prescient understanding of what is going to happen in the future.
Tune in when the Leon Charney Report begins a special series on the Israeli-Palestinian question.
So don't accept defeat.
Now you can get covered in steel.
Buy me treats.
You take care of your pets. Now it's their turn to take care of you. Visit GetCoveredAmerica.org to learn about your health insurance options.
Thanks for calling the GED Pep Talk Center. Jerry Stiller speaking. Your level 7 in your face pep talk.
I can keep pushing. Believe me, I'm good at it. But at some point, you're going to need to start pushing yourself.
See, once you've got your GED diploma, you'll feel so good about yourself.
You tough. Can't change your past, but you can definitely change your future.
That makes me so happy, I'm ready to bust out a dance.
Mr. Trejo, can I transfer this guy to you? My gentle technique isn't really working. You need something a little more
persuasive.
Yes.
You listen, and you listen good.
Hey, where's my sandwich? Terry? Terry!
Take it from me to King DMC. It's a real cool thing to get your GED.
Get that diploma!
Now hold on and we'll find you free GED classes. Capiche?
Whatever motivation you need, we've got a pep talk for you. Get your GED pep talk and find free classes at yourged.org.
I wish I was in school.
If only I had a math
I'll stay after class.
I'll clean the chalkboard.
I wish I was in school.
School ends, but free lunches for your kids don't have to. Find your local food bank at feedingamerica.org/summermeals for help.
We're back with Paul Bremer. You all know who he is. He was the civil administrator for Iraq for the first year after we captured Baghdad and we saw the great statue of Hussein coming down. All right, Paul, so tell me, in your opinion, why it was important to get to Iraq and to start this, whatever we have over there.
I think, like most people, I believe that Saddam Hussein still had weapons of mass destruction. He, after all, had used them against his own people and against the Iranians in the 80s, chemical weapons. He had refused to comply with 17 consecutive UN resolutions. There must have been a reason. He hadn't come clean. Not only did our CIA think he had these weapons, but all of the major intelligence services in the world, the British, the Germans, the French,
the Israelis.
The Germans, the French, and the Russians didn't support the war, but their intelligence services all thought he had them. So I thought he had them. And my concern, having been chairman of the National Commission on Terrorism, was the possibility that a country like Iraq, which had long supported terrorists, might get weapons of mass destruction into the hands of some of these Islamic extremists that we had reported to President Clinton about. So I supported the war. And I thought, secondly, that it was important in the broad strategic sense to try to help countries in the Middle East get democratic governments. Israel's really the only valid democracy in the region.
Right.
And a lot of these terrorists, these Islamic extremists, come out of a swamp where there is authoritarian, non-representative government. So I also supported the president's idea that as part of a grand strategy to defeat Islamic extremism, we should promote representative government. And I thought that was an important part of why we went into Iraq also.
Was Secretary of State Powell for this or against it?
I don't know. He never expressed himself as being against it. To me, when I came back into government, there were, of course, a lot of press stories around about his rivalry with Rumsfeld. I must say Secretary Powell gave me great support. I had lots and lots of American diplomats seconded to my coalition authority during the time I was there. I at one point, I had 5 serving American ambassadors whom he just pulled out of their posts and sent to Baghdad to help heavy up our team. These are all Arabic-speaking, which I'm not, Arabic-speaking diplomats. So I had good support from state.
Do you believe, see, I have a theory. I've worked in the Middle East and, you know, was involved with the Camp David and all that. Today, with Al Jazeera and the Internet, I believe that most of the fundamental policies are carried out by religious clerics and not by governments. And I think that the people, whatever they hear in the mosque on Friday, or even the Orthodox Haredi Jews on Saturday, when the rabbis say maybe you should not go in and fight against another Jew to remove him from a territory, they have greater influence than the political authorities or the dictatorial authorities today. Do you take that as a given today also?
I'm not enough of an area expert.
Theological expert.
I've lived in Afghanistan. It was my first post, and I've lived now in Iraq, and I visited all these
countries.
Why
don't you go to Bermuda? I remember the ambassador from Bermuda, who, when Jimmy Carter was president, greeted me once. He had the flag up and the sirens. Where was he going? To the casino that night. Why do you pick places like Afghanistan?
Well, I don't know about you, but I think I'd find Bermuda pretty boring.
It is. I mean, you can't get exactly excited if you get a blackjack, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's not the greatest
not
thing in the world.
Thing.
But usually the heavy donors get those posts.
Right.
So it means you were not
a heavy
donor. I
didn't see too many political guys volunteering for Baghdad.
No. All right, so you remember that famous picture of Powell in front of the United Nations talking about the weapons of mass destruction. Then there's this great crisis between what the CIA told them and what he learned. And, you know, he looked embarrassed. He wasn't embarrassed. It was a tricky thing because Powell has a great credibility in the world and the United States. What did, you know, in my gut, I feel that Saddam Hussein still has or had weapons of mass destruction. I believe someplace they're hidden. I don't have to,
it doesn't
have to be very big. I had 2 guys who worked on that area. One was the former ambassador to Australia who became at the UN. I forgot his name. He was on the show talking about it. Then there was the other fellow who worked under him, who wrote a book about it, who changed his... I can't remember these two guys, but we talked about it a lot. Yeah. And these guys were convinced that there were pretty bad things in Saddam Hussein's arsenal. All right, so the premise of going into Iraq was based upon two things. A, trying to get a democracy going in the Middle East, because Israel was a soloist there as a democracy, and B, we were really terrified about weapons of mass destruction. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, I would say it's the other way around. I think if you go back and look at the statements by the President, Secretary of State, and others, the primary emphasis was on weapons of mass destruction.
All right. Do you believe that there are weapons of mass destruction today?
I don't honestly know. I mean,
Are you frustrated by this?
You mentioned that you thought they could be hidden. It's interesting. While I was there, about 2 months after I was there, you may remember, we found three MiG-27s, fully equipped MiGs, buried in the sand out in the western desert, which raised a question in a lot of people's mind about, this is a country the size of California. It's a big country. Whether they could have hidden it somewhere else. I don't know. We had reports at the time that maybe there were mysterious movements of trucks, especially from the Russian embassy, across the Syrian border at the time of the war. Did he maybe take some of this stuff into Syria? I really don't know. In any case, I had a lot of other things that I had to worry about. Once I was there, the question was, how are we going to put this place back together? That was my main concern.
Yeah, but many people talk about the fact that Bush was trying to get Hussein because of his father, the attack on his father, and he wanted to, you know, get even for that. Many people talk about the oil business. I'm not sure that's the reason.
Well, I don't believe either of those things. I mean, if you can go back and look at the statements by political leaders of both parties, by the way, including President Clinton, there was a very broad consensus that Saddam must not be allowed to have and hide and perhaps use weapons of mass destruction. And it was the view of most of the intelligence services in the world that he had them. Why else was he lying to the UN and not cooperating? I've heard this idea that we did it for oil. This is just not... I sat in, I don't know how many hundreds of hours of meetings with top American officials, both in Baghdad and Washington and elsewhere. I never heard anybody say, you know, we did this for the oil. It's just not...
You know, it's the people in the street that say it, you know?
I understand, but it's just not the case.
You remember this guy Chalabi? What was his name?
The CIA? Ahmed Chalabi.
Yeah. Was he an important factor in any of this?
Well, he was a contact that our government had had quite a lot of contact with, a guy in exile. He'd been out of the country since 1958. Like most of the exiles, he was pretty far removed from recent developments in Iraq. That was one of the problems. One of the problems about building a new Iraqi representative government was that Saddam had pretty much killed off all the political leaders who stayed in Iraq, and so the guys who were outside Iraq but hadn't been there for 20 years were the only politically savvy people. Trouble was they didn't have much support inside the country, including Chalabi, who in the elections, he had a party list that he led. He didn't even get himself elected. He didn't even win one seat. So it shows you that these emigres, which is not surprising, really didn't have much support inside the country.
The key rap, shall I say, about the decisions that were made in Iraq is that the dismantlement of the army, the Iraqi army. And I think people say that that was your decision. Is that correct or incorrect?
No, it's not correct. I recommended it, and I think it was the right decision. Here are the facts.
Okay.
Saddam used his army as the primary instrument of repression of the Iraqi people. They conducted a decade-long genocidal war against the Kurds in the north in the 80s, killing hundreds of thousands of them and using chemical weapons on them.
After the Gulf War, too.
That's the Shia. Right. Yeah, then they went after the Shia. He killed hundreds of thousands of Shia in the south. The army was made up of about 315,000 Shia draftees. It was a conscript army who served under mostly Sunni officers who hazed them, harassed them, beat them. And when these conscripts saw which way the war was going, they went home. There was no army left by the time of the fall of Baghdad. Not a single unit was standing in place anywhere in the country. So the question was, do we recall Saddam's army?
Right.
Well, recalling the main instrument of Saddam's terror would have been a political mistake of the first order. So instead, we built a new army. And by the way, two things that are often overlooked. We said anybody from the old army who wants to volunteer for the new one, it was a volunteer army, is welcome to volunteer, and we'll take people up to the level of colonel, up to the rank of colonel. And we said, anybody who doesn't get a job, we will put on pension, and the pension will be calculated to be more than they would have made if they'd stayed in the army. And we started paying those pensions 2 months after I got there, and those pensions were paid all during the time we were there, all during the next governments of Iraq, the independent governments of Iraq. So I don't exclude that some of these guys from the old army went off and joined the insurgency, of course. But they weren't doing it for money. They were doing it because they were Sunnis who wanted to seize power and did not believe that democracy was going to serve their purposes.
This is a big issue that people are not clear about, you know, and obviously people don't read all the facts. So they say, okay, Paul Bremer, he dismissed the army.
Right.
So that was a fatal mistake. But the right. way you explain it doesn't sound, it sounds pretty logical. Maybe you're not supposed to be.
You know, and it was not a controversial decision at the time. It was coordinated with the Secretary of Defense. The President was aware of it. The chiefs, Joint Chiefs of Staff were aware of it. The local commander on the ground was aware of it. And these people all provided edits in the draft order. I mean, it was not a big controversial decision because basically it was logical.
By the way, how big a staff did you have?
My staff grew to about 3,000 civilians. They were all men and women. They were from 25 different countries. They were all volunteers, every single one of them. Wonderful group of men and women.
Do you speak Arabic? You know what inshallah means?
Yeah, I sure do.
That's all they say all day, is inshallah. All right, so you're over there and you're trying to build a civil administration, but you basically in your mind know that there were not enough troops coming over there, so you had to really try to build something out of what you had on the ground. And you saw that there was a lot of looting, a lot of police, a lot of terrorism. So how do you do this? How do you start to do it?
Well, what I tried to do was get the economy going, and we took steps to do that right away, get a group of representative Iraqis put together as a provisional kind of government.
How did you choose them?
Well, we sent Arabic-speaking officers, diplomatic officers from America, Britain, Japan, Romania, people who knew the language, Poland, into the provinces to try to identify local leaders, lawyers, women's activists, judges, businessmen, who might be presentable as a representative group of Iraqis, which was then announced 2 months after I got there by the UN special representative. That government, in turn, appointed the ministers who ran all of the 25 ministries in Iraq, Ministry of Transportation, Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Health. And I never overruled those ministers. I had the authority. I could have overruled them, but I didn't. I let them run the government.
So you basically were like a facilitator to bring
right.
these people in to function, because you had a whole society to take care of. All right, we got a break, and we'll come right back. This is riveting and very telling, because a lot of people don't know the facts about Iraq and the whole war in Iraq. And in my opinion, it's going to be the huge subject for the next election. And I'm not so sure. I predict for a year now a Republican is going to win the election. That's aside from Paul Bremer's interview. I don't know if he's a Republican or Democrat. This is Charney speaking. We'll be right back.
Peace means taking into account the dignity of other people and the fact that there are other people who have certain rights.
Peace in the Middle East basically will come when the clergy in the mosque on Friday preach it and when the rabbis in the synagogue on Saturday preach it. During the time of Camp David I, you had political leadership that was able to contain that type of religious fervor. What the country needs is some prescient understanding of what is going to happen in the future.
Tune in when the Leon Charney Report begins a special series on the Israeli-Palestinian question.
Throw away money on wasted electricity. You're throwing away everything you could have bought with it. Saving energy saves you money,
Learn more at energysavers.gov.
Kitchen surfaces, utensils, and hands with soapy water. 1 in 6 Americans will get sick from food poisoning this year. Keep your family safer. Check your steps at foodsafety.gov.
Hey, going out like that?
Yeah, why?
Well, what would the neighbors think?
I see you! Come look at Mr. Feather!
Look what I have.
Mr. Bird, remember?
Bark, bark, bark!
We're just playing!
Even still.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you.
Can you sit with me? Imagine what you'd see if every child had a book to read.
Because every kid across the nation deserves a book to read. And we can make it happen right now.
No, I don't know what you've been told. But kids with books learn so much more.
Read to a child today and spark a lifetime of ambition.
Know what?
What?
Since I got adopted, I've learned a lot about these humans.
I know. I mean, check out these two. It's Flirt City over here.
Yeah, I noticed that. It looks like my human is definitely into your human.
Oh, look! I think she's getting his number.
Nice.
Your human's got some sweet moves.
Takes after his dog. Oh, look, they're doing that thing where they put their arms around each other.
She kicked up a leg. It's like in the movies.
That's awesome. Looks like we're going to be hanging out a little bit more.
We're back with riveting television. Paul Bremer, who was the administrator of Iraq 1 year after we captured Baghdad, basically. Were you there physically when they got Hussein? Were you in the
yes.
country?
Yes, I was.
Yeah. Why did you feel that day?
Well, it was quite an exciting event. I had just gone to bed that Saturday night, Baghdad time, about 1:30.
What is bed called in Iraq? Is it a fancy bedroom and everything? Is it a cot?
Well, trailers. We were living in trailers. My chief of staff called me and said that General Abizaid, who was in charge of CENTCOM, wanted to talk to me on the secure phone. So I got my security detail. I went back to the office and spoke to Abizaid about 2 o'clock in the morning. He said, "We think we've captured Saddam Hussein." He told me the story of what had happened outside of Tikrit in the north. And he said, "We're going to fly him down to Baghdad this evening, or this morning, right now, and put him in front of some of the other high-value detainees like Tariq Aziz and Ramadan, his vice presidents, and ask them to identify him. He seems to have the scars that we know he has, but we know he uses doubles. And we're going to take a DNA sample, and we have to fly it to Germany, which is where the DNA is." And I said, "Well, how long is it going to take to confirm the DNA?" And he said, "Well, 24 to 36 hours. I said, "There's no way in the world this story is going to hold for 24 to 36 hours. We got to move faster than that." Well, by about 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, Baghdad time, we had confirmation that it was Saddam from these eyewitnesses. And so I called Dr. Rice. By then it was 1 o'clock in the morning in Washington, and I told her, "It looks like this is the guy." And she said, "Well, I'm going to call the president. He's up at Camp David." So, and then we announced it that afternoon, Baghdad time, 3 o'clock Baghdad time.
Did you meet him?
Yes, I took a group of Iraqi politicians. We knew that the Iraqis are very, like a lot of people in that part of the world, very suspicious and rumors and bizarre. Reason we hadn't captured Saddam,
according to... We had doubles all the time also.
And the rumor in the bazaar, since we hadn't captured him for 6 months, was that we had actually done a deal. Well, we had captured him. We'd done a deal with him, and he was living in happy retirement on what they called a ranch in Florida. So we knew we had
to... By the way, they said the same about Hitler, that he was living, he escaped by submarine to Argentina. There are people believe it, and he's still living in Argentina. Yeah. He'd be 110 years old, you know?
Well, we knew as a result we needed to get some Iraqis to see him and then go before the Iraqi people on television and say, we saw him, it is him. So I took a group of 5 Iraqi politicians out to where he was being held in a secret location that same afternoon. And I played no part in the discussion. It was a very emotional. Several of them had actually been tortured by Saddam's henchmen. All of them had relatives killed by Saddam. It was a very emotional meeting for them. Saddam had no idea who I was. He wasn't watching a lot of television in that spider hole.
Did he speak any English, or you don't know?
I don't know.
So you really got out of it. The military handled it, became a trial with the Iraqi people. So you really didn't have that much to do with it.
Well, eventually, I mean, we still had, until we ceded sovereignty to the Iraqis, we had responsibility for Saddam. And then after we ceded sovereignty, when the Iraqis asked, got their special tribunal set, and asked for us to deliver him to them for trial, we did that. That was after I left.
Did you think that was a breakthrough in the whole
capturing
business?
Him? Yeah. Well, we thought it was going to, and in fact, we thought it would help persuade some of the followers of his that there was no further point in resistance. And in fact, in the 3 weeks after we captured him, attacks in the insurgency dropped by 23%. So we thought maybe, and we got some feelers from some insurgent groups in Bakuba and out in Anbar saying, you know, can we figure out some way? We did some very quiet local ceasefires to see if they could deliver on their side. The ceasefires fell apart very quickly. So in the end, it didn't have the effect we'd hoped it would have.
Did you ever meet Tariq Aziz?
No.
He was a pretty intelligent character, wasn't he? I mean, he was the foreign minister at one time, wasn't
right.
he? And he kept double-talking everybody, but he always seemed intelligent. I know people talked to him.
He was not
a foolish guy. Did you know very explicitly what the difference of a Shiite and a Sunni was?
My first assignment as a diplomat was in Afghanistan, where it's actually, you know, almost entirely Sunni with some Shia.
You know, my theory is that if Muhammad had a male heir, you wouldn't have all this problem. The whole thing came about because he had only daughters. And therefore, the Shiites and the Sunnis, they separated. One was cousins, one was brother-in-laws. And this is going on forever. Very few people know this.
Yeah. Well, not forever, only 1,200 years.
When you met the Shiites individually, did you feel that they were more understanding of what you're trying to accomplish, or the Sunnis were? Sunnis basically are in Jordan and Egypt, and you know that we did know more about the Sunnis. What did you feel about that?
Well, the fundamental strategic fact was that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the introduction of representative government meant that the millennium-long domination of Mesopotamia by the Sunnis was over. They dominated under the Turks, they dominated under the British, they dominated under Saddam, and they're a minority, probably 20% of the population. This has been hard for the Sunnis to accept and understand, and it's been hard for the Shia to understand the other side of that, which is that democracy also means respecting minority rights. You can't just run roughshod over those guys. This is, of course, what is at the heart of the difficulties of reconciliation now.
Is the rancor so strong between them because of religious, theological ideals? Is that they're really angry at one another?
No.
What is
the history in Iraq, people say, well, it was inevitable that there would be sectarian strife. That's not true.
By the way, Mesopotamia was where Abraham was born, in case you forgot.
That's right.
A lot of people don't remember that.
That's right. The father of the religions.
For
generations, Shia and Sunnis in Iraq have intermarried. Every major tribe in Iraq has both Shia and Sunni members. During the time that I was there, we counted fewer than 100 sectarian murders in 14 months. There was basically very little sectarian violence. What happened was Al-Qaeda set out a policy. It was very clear. We found it in a letter we intercepted from the head of al-Qaeda, Abu Musab Zarqawi, where he said, we're going to kill as many innocent Shia as possible, men, women, and children, to provoke them to attack the Sunnis so that we can have a sectarian, set off a sectarian war. And that's what happened. When we didn't provide adequate security to protect those people from the Sunni terrorists, they turned to their militia, particularly the militia of Muqtada al-Sadr. And you got into a spiral. So it worked. Al-Qaeda's strategy was successful in provoking a sectarian war.
But, Paul, are you telling me that it was a political move or a religious one?
It was purely political.
Just political.
But, I mean, it has... I mean,
its origins are in religion.
Yeah, you have to say that Al-Qaeda's vision, which we know because they took over Afghanistan, we know what their vision is. Their vision is a theocracy, basically a theocratic government.
Do you believe that the vision of the fundamental right-wing Islamics is to really recapture the Western world? And that's part of their doctrine?
Well, that's what they say. And they've said it very consistently. That was one of the reasons why the National Commission on Terrorism that I chaired felt so strongly about alerting people to this danger. We went back and looked at the statements, the fatwas, the press conferences, and more recently the web postings of al-Qaeda, bin Laden, Zawahiri, his deputy, and others. And it's very clear. They've said it over and over. They intend to reestablish a universal caliphate. They're very clear. I mean, I don't know what more you can say. One should take this.
All right, you're a terrorism expert. So now, let's say we know that. Is there any way to prevent it? Their population is greater than the Western population. How does one prevent it?
We need a multi-pronged strategy that uses all of the weapons in our panoply, everything from political and economic, covert action, culture, everything. And the main part of a grand strategy is promoting representative government, to drain the swamp of hatred out of which this terrorism comes. And we have to find ways everywhere possible to support moderate Arabs. These are extremists. This is a very small percent of the Arab world, the Muslim world. We have to help the moderates win that civil war inside of Islam any way we can.
All right. So the big question, and I have this problem all the time, if you read the Quran literally, it can be a very tough book. If you read the Torah literally,
I was going to say parts of the Bible, and particularly what I call the Old Testament, are pretty rough,
right,
too.
They could be. No, they are. Yeah. And if you didn't have the Talmud, and the Babylonian and the Jerusalem Talmud, you know, it'd be extremes, you know.
Right.
Even the idea of kosher. Kosher only means you shouldn't cook a kid in its goat's milk. Otherwise, then you got this always flowing through matzahs, you know, today on Passover. But the problem is, and I've asked this of a lot of rabbis, in Jewish religion we have modern conservative and we have a lot of scholarship and the Talmud. We're looking for a lot of people in the Islamic or who are Muslims who are broad in their interpretations, because I think this is what people need to know. Because I used to think, when I was in Israel especially, that a suicide terrorist was a person who didn't have a roof and is with poor and his kids. Mm-hmm. He wanted to feed it. No more. Yeah. You have lawyers with children. Yeah. That whole profile has changed. Tell me about it.
Well, that was really never a profile. If you look, I was involved in fighting terrorism in the 70s and 80s.
And that's why I brought you on the show.
These old-style terrorists didn't believe in suicide. There were very few suicides between 1968, when the new terrorism started after the 67 war, until really the end of the 80s.
Right.
These new guys have a different way of looking at it. They believe that they're going to be rewarded in some fashion for killing themselves. And if you look at what happened in the 90s, suicide attacks escalated very dramatically in the 90s, particularly, of course, in Israel, but elsewhere.
But why?
Because of this
vision. The promise of heaven.
Well, a vision. I mean, you have to hold out an end-of-times vision to get people to kill themselves like that. And the vision was put forward by people like bin Laden. Bin Laden is a centimillionaire. He's not a poor
man. Yeah, I know. I use that all the time. And he sends other people out. He doesn't kill himself.
And Zawahiri, his deputy, is an Egyptian. He's an upper-class Egyptian. He's a medical doctor. These people are not
we're on the same page.
Poor people.
I'm trying to figure this thing out for 15 years. I'm trying to figure it out from the Israeli side and the Palestinian side. And you've been in Afghanistan and Iraq. And this is the huge problem. I mean, how do you prevent those people who become so ingrained with the fact that there's a better life in another place that they're willing to sacrifice their lives and sacrifice other people's. And this is the fundamental problem now. All right, we've got to cut for a break. We'll come back. We got one more quarter left, and this is great and riveting television, and we're getting facts that a lot of us don't know. And I guess if you want to know more, you should read the book. It's called My Year in Iraq, The Struggle to Build a Future of Hope. That's a nice statement. And we're optimistic, so we're hopeful. We'll be right back.
Nice.
Yes, go! Yes, yes, yes!
No!
Come
on!
Oops.
Yeah, sure.
Let's go.
Moms everywhere are finding ways to keep kids active and healthy.
Works every time.
Get ideas, get involved, get going at letsmove.gov.
So, I got this new family, and I don't know what it is about this one, but she can't seem to put down that toy all day long. Tap, 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 tap. Oh, and she even talks to it. She talks to that more than she talks to him. What's up, bro? Nice shirt. Who's she talking to? Her mom? She talks to her mom a lot.
We're back with Paul Bremer, who's really an interesting man. I should be calling him ambassador because he was an ambassador. Still is. I guess he retained the title. But more importantly, he put a year into Iraq and Afghanistan and knows a lot about terrorism, and we're following his trail a little bit. Give me an example of a day in Iraq. I mean, did you sleep at all? Were you able to sleep?
Not very much.
You able to eat? I mean, how did you live over there? I mean,
well, we worked out of one of Saddam's old palaces, as you know.
Right.
It was not very palatial. When I got there, we had no running water, no electricity, so no air conditioning.
I'll tell you who has a great palace, by the way, Assad in Syria. Have you ever been there?
Yes, I have, yeah.
It's bigger than Yankee Stadium.
Yeah.
Okay, so
not as successful.
that's true.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have to put up with Boston, though.
I
usually got up around 4:30 in the morning because that's when the mortar or rockets started coming in. I was at my desk. I tried to exercise for half an hour, and I was at my desk at 6. And then the day usually ended somewhere around 1 or 2 in the morning. The next day, so it was pretty long.
Yeah, but so you get fatigued, you know. And do you believe that people after a certain time can really make good decisions with such fatigue?
Well, you have to pace yourself, obviously. And we found that people were really getting run down, so we decided to have a half work day on Friday. People would come to work at midday, Friday being the day that in theory it is closed. Didn't work very well, but things got started anyway a few hours later on Fridays, and that gave people a little bit of chance to rest, but mostly it was 7 days a week.
Could you move around in the city at all?
I could and I did, but it was a pretty major production.
Really?
Yeah.
A lot of security.
Yeah.
What is the thing with these IEDs? What is that? Is it obviously they're explosives that are found on the roads.
Right.
The Israelis were technically working on something that could prevent it, and
right.
I say it's about 2 years off. But those were really dangerous, and there's no way to protect against that, huh?
Well, we had some systems for trying to. They're usually remotely detonated
right.
by cell phones
right.
or garage openers. Sometimes
right.
they're done by wire. It's harder to stop them when they're by wire. But if they're rely on an electronic signal, you have some capacity to disrupt the signal. I survived an IED attack on the Baghdad Road we were talking about earlier,
really?
The airport road, yeah.
It was key to keep that airport open all the time, wasn't it?
It was important to keep it open, yeah.
Tell me about the banking system. That always interests me. Did they have a Federal Reserve governor?
They had a central bank. They had a central bank who basically took orders from Saddam every Friday. During his time, Saddam would call him up or have his guy call him up and say, here's how many dinars to print the next week. When we got there, the Minister of Planning told me, acting Minister of Planning, told me that inflation, as a result of that, at the end of 2002 was running at 115,000%, basically Weimar level inflation. The banks were all state-owned. They were all closed by the time I got there. They had, in any case, no capacity for checking accounts, no electronic transfers, no internet, no telephones. So there was no banking system.
You had to pay in
Everything
cash.
Had to be paid
That's
in
like,
cash.
That's like the old Soviet Union, by the way. I was in the Soviet Union. Yeah. I used to get a ticket, an airline ticket, come in with a bunch of rubles, you know?
Yeah.
So there was no system. So you can't function in a society without a system.
Well, we got the banks open. We had, I think, 340 branches around the country. We got them open by the 1st of October 2003. But our real problem was the currency. The currency had depreciated to essentially being worthless. And we were putting about $300 million in Iraqi money, dollars, into the economy every month. And my advisors said, we're going to dollarize this economy if we don't do something. So we actually introduced a new currency. In the middle of a war, it was an amazing operation.
They printed a new currency?
We had them printed. They were not printed in Iraq. They were printed in Britain and in Spain. And we brought in effectively 37 4-7s full of new currency. It was about 6,000 tons of new currency, which we then had to transfer throughout the whole country in the middle of a war because there was no banking system.
But the U.S. found a ton of cash, didn't they?
We found just short of $1 billion, $965 million of cash in various parts of the country.
What happens to that money, by the way?
That goes into the Iraqi budget, and we spent it on paying for ministry expenses. We were running expenses on the order of about $12 billion a year to run the government. So we needed a lot of money.
You had a lot of issues with electricity, I remember.
Yeah.
It was hard to get electricity.
Yeah.
Has that been solved to this day?
Well, solved is too strong a word. We set out a target of getting back to pre-war levels of electricity by October 1st, 2003, which we were able to do. But Saddam's pre-war level, the amount of electricity that was available, really only met about 50% of demand. And what he did, therefore, was he wheeled power from the provinces into Baghdad. So Baghdad, if you were in Baghdad and you were a reporter, you would be reporting where you got 16, 17 hours of power a day. If you're in Basra, you had 2 hours. Well, I set up a policy that said we got to share the power around, so the power in Baghdad went down. Meanwhile, of course, the economy started to really boom. People were allowed finally to have satellite dishes, so people bought television, they bought refrigerators, they bought television sets. And so demand was going up faster. Last week, power supply was about 10% more than a year ago, but it still is short of demand. There's no question about that. They're going to have to build a lot of power plants.
You told me something very interesting during our break, that most of the people who were in Iraq, I think soldiers and maybe other people, would go back in 5 minutes. They all volunteered. Why is that?
Well, I think the people who worked with us in the Coalition Provisional Authority felt that they were engaged in an historic, important thing. All of us came to be, I think, very, very respectful of the Iraqi people and their history. They have a long, long, proud history going back 7,000 years. And I think all of us felt that we were doing something important. And it is true. I talk to these guys. I see them every year. We have a reunion. And there are a lot of them who say, boy, I would go back tomorrow if I were asked.
You want to go back?
No, I don't want to go back. I did my time.
Stay here with Catholic Charities. You know,
right.
It's better. My question, obviously, is where do you see the future here? What do you think is going to happen in Iran?
I'm optimistic about the situation, provided we show patience, which is not the most obvious national characteristic of Americans. But we've got finally now, I think, the right military strategy on the ground, which is beginning to improve security, which is the sine qua non, and always was. It's now beginning to show signs of promoting reconciliation, which is good. They've made a deal on oil revenue sharing just a week ago, which I hope they'll be able to implement. So we're going to have to be patient. We're going to have to stick it out. I think it is true that the Iraqis can now pay for a lot more of this than they have been. They're going to produce about $60 billion of revenue this year. That's about
from
three
oil?
Times.
Is that oil?
Yeah. That's the only source of revenue.
They have enough refineries there that work?
No. They never had enough refineries.
I know. You know who has no refineries? Iran.
Same problem.
Right. So they have to build refineries. Now, I'm sure there are major corporations that are willing to come in there. Are they willing to come in and invest in Iran?
Not until the security is better. There are investors there, but they tend to be from the Gulf states who have a different threshold of risk than most multinationals. I think once security gets stabilized, there are going to be a lot of opportunities. They've got a lot of water. They've got good land. They've got agricultural possibilities quite beyond the oil and gas.
Give me your best experience there.
I think the best experience was when we got a constitution written for the Iraqi people. They all wanted a new constitution, and on March 1st, 2004, at 4:15 in the morning, the Iraqis basically finished drafting what is a very good constitution.
So if I say to you, there is a democracy in the Middle East other than Israel, would you say Iraq is a democracy
Absolutely.
Today?
Absolutely. So they had three elections in 2005.
So that's an achievement.
Yes.
That's a huge achievement.
But that's an achievement of the Iraqi people. Don't forget, the terrorists said, if you go and vote in these elections, we will kill you. They said, you vote, you die. And what happened? 12 million Iraqis, you remember the pictures with the fingers, 12 million Iraqis went and voted. That's quite an accomplishment.
Do you think, and I don't want to get political here, that anyone who becomes the president of the United States, he or she, can pull out troops immediately from Iraq?
I think it would be very dangerous. I think the consequences would be three. First of all, there would likely be an uptick in violence inside Iraq, perhaps even a bloodbath. Secondly, Iraq would probably come apart. I think the Kurds would probably decide to secede from Iraq, which would then provoke a broader regional war, drawing in not only Turkey, but also Iran. The Iranians have a very large Kurdish minority. And thirdly, it would give al-Qaeda a huge a political victory where they would say, we drove the Soviets out of Afghanistan, we drove the Americans out of Iraq, and that would endanger every one of our lives.
The last question, a big issue in Israel is Iran and the promise of its president to destroy Israel. Are you personally worried about Iran with its nuclear power today?
Absolutely, I am. They've been lying. They lied for 20 years to the International Energy Agency about their nuclear program. Ahmed Injadad doesn't miss a chance to brag about how he's now got 6,000 more centrifuges of a higher quality. I don't know anybody who, again, it's not just the American government, who doesn't believe that the Iranians intend to get a nuclear weapon. And that really changes the balance of power, not just in Israel's terms, but in the terms of the other Arab countries.
Paul, we're out of time. You've been a pleasure.
Good to see you again.
See you another 15 years. No, before that, we'll bring him back. He's a great American. I mean, he did a lot of service to the country, and no one knows really what happened until you read the history. So I give him kudos for, A, being a great American, B, for coming on the show, because I think the people need to hear it. We'll see you next week.